Welcome to Bergonomics, demystifying economics with Ross McDowell.
Welcome everybody to the Bergonomics podcast, where we're going to discuss why our steak costs so much, why Australian beef is the world's most expensive. Joining me today is Mr. Rob Clayton. Rob is the Managing Director of Nutrien Ag Solutions. And Rob, welcome.
Thank you, Ross. It's great to be here.
Can you please tell us a little bit about Nutrien and about your career?
Sure. So Nutrien is a dual-listed entity on the New York and Toronto Stock Exchange. It's got a market cap of about $40 billion. We operate in seven countries around the world, but North America, South America, and Australia. There's two sides to the Nutrien Ag Solutions business. So the Nutrien or Nutrien Inc. business that we call, or Big Nutrien, we like to call it internally, is really a fertilizer production company. So they're the largest global producer of potash and the third largest producer of nitrogen in the world. And then there's the Nutrien Ag Solutions, or the retail side of the business, and again, operates in North America, South America, and of course Australia, and I lead that business in Australia, and that's a retail business and really services the input needs of farmers across those two continents or three continents. The Australian business is quite unique in itself in that the North American and the South American businesses only service the crop inputs business, so fertilizer, seed, crop protection products. And here in Australia, because of the makeup of the market, we also do wool, we do livestock, we do insurance, finance, really everything a farmer, sort of a one-stop shop for farmers and the farmers that we service.
Okay, and tell me about you and your career and how you've ended up where you've ended up.
Sure, so I'm a farm kid from northern New South Wales. My mum and
whereabouts?
In Canamble, northern New South Wales. It was probably, we'll talk a bit about the drought later on, no doubt. And it's quite wet up there at the moment. So we do live in the land of droughts and flooding rains. So we're very used to that in agriculture. So I always thought I'd be a farmer, left school and thought I'd go and work for IAMA at the time. This is 22 years ago. And at the time I was a trainee agronomist. I was checking for bugs in cotton crops in the morning, and then I was holding a flag way before GPS came around for the crop dusters to spray the fields. And I fell in love with it, to be honest. Again, I thought I'd always go back to the farm, and I never did. And I fell in love with it because I got addicted to really seeing farmers move forward in production, farmers be successful, and what a company like Nutrien Ag Solutions can do to bring global technology to growers and really, increase what is a really big job of feeding the world. Like it's something for me from a purpose point of view. There's not many other jobs where you can really make a difference in the world, and feeding the world is one of the really core tasks that we need to do.
So you've made the jump from the pasture to the management in the office.
Yeah, well, it's sort of a jump, but I guess I'd say it was a slow jump, if you like, in the sense of I've been with the company 22 years, or I'm going into my 22nd year. I started in 2000. I've been the managing director for about the last 4 years, so just going into my fifth year now.
Okay. Let's have a look at why our steaks are costing us so much money. In Australia, we've always believed we're the land of plenty when it comes to our meat, grains, things that we even dig out of the land. But at the moment, if I go to the supermarket, I'm looking at $24 a kilo for rump, $55 a kilo for Scotch fillet, $67 a kilo for eye fillet. So we are paying a lot of money for beef in this country, the most expensive in the world. That's not something that most Australians would really ever think that would be in that position. Are we paying these incredibly high prices because of the drought that started in 2017?
Yeah, so it is a bit of a long story, but it's a story of, as an economist, you'll very much understand of supply and demand. So maybe if I start the story, back in 2015, We just come off a fairly dry period in agriculture, and we went into 2016, and the season was pretty strong. So we started to kind of rebuild our herd a little bit out of that sort of 13, 14, 15. They were okay years, but they weren't that great. So we started to rebuild the herd a little bit out. So the Australian herd is normally fluctuating somewhere between 25 million head and 29 million head, somewhere in that range. When we get up to 29 million, it seems like we run into dry weather and we start to sell down. And when we run into good seasons, we start to build up a bit. And I'll talk more about that in a second.
And the herd, you're talking
the cattle about herd. Beef, I'm definitely talking about the beef,
lamb, or just
no,
beef.
No, just the yep. beef herd. So in Australia, there's as I said, between 25 and 29 million cattle, about 70 million sheep.
Yep.
We're the second largest exporter of beef in the world.
Yep.
We're only 2% of the beef herd in the world. So we've got a reasonably small herd size, but we don't consume much. We export about 70% of the beef that we produce. So we're very fixed to kind of global markets. When you think about 70% of our beef is, so we are the land of plenty in the sense of we grow way more food than we can consume because we're a large country with a big land mass, as you're no doubt aware, but we've got a very small herd. So the US has got about a 300 million population. In fact, a lot of our beef will go into, they do export some of their cattle, but they consume more than they export a lot more. So if I go back to my kind of seasonal story a bit, because it is a bit of a macro story and then a micro story. So the story begins with 2016, things are looking okay. Then we run into 2017 and it starts to dry off. You know, the farmers don't know whether it's going to be the drought that we had, which was really the millennial drought or the one in 100 year drought of 17, 18 and 19. To give you a bit of evidence of how bad particularly 18 and 19 was, my parents in Canamble had more rain in March 2020 than they had in 18 and 19 combined. So it was a very dry period. So we run into this drought in 2017, which again, as the grass is going away, farmers start to do sort of some preliminary measures. So, because they don't know when it's going to rain, you know, no one's really can predict, you know, it's going to rain in the next month or the next year. You know, predictions get pretty accurate when we get 2 or 3 weeks out. The longer out, the less accurate they are. So the first thing a farmer would do when things start to turn dry is they'll sell off some of their young stock, they'll sell off everything but really their breeding stock. So their core breeding stock, that'll be their kind of last line of defence. So we got into 2017, we're starting to sell off. Then in 2018, farmers know things are pretty bad.
Can I just ask a question here? So they're starting to sell off.
Yes.
What's happening to the price of beef as they're starting
well,
to sell
well,
off?
Contrary to probably popular demand, the global consumption of beef has continued to rise. So I know we hear a lot about vegans and so on, and good luck to vegans. I'm not a vegan myself, but I've got no issue with people can eat whatever they want to eat.
Yep.
But the fact is global consumption of beef is rising at about 1% per annum.
Okay, so you're in a situation where normally they'd be selling off their herd, and if it was just the Australian market, prices would be going down,
yes,
but they didn't go down because global demand was going up.
They stayed pretty strong, I would say, and it's the first time in my career we've had a drought and we've also had pretty strong prices at the same time, and that's about global demand.
Yep.
But I'll throw in a bit of a black swan event that happened just in 2018, which really, I would say, turbocharged that situation. So we had African swine flu that came along. So for those who don't know, the largest consumption of meat around the world is pigs or hogs or whatever, you know, whatever jurisdiction you call them, you might call pigs. And half the pigs in the world live in China, or they did live in China. They still do today. About 480 million pigs were living in China in 2018. And when African swine flu came along, they had to slaughter about half of those pigs. And if you put it in the context of, you know, global protein, in 2018, there was about 17 million tons of pig, so still protein meat, exited the market in one foul swoop. And if you think about 17 million tons, our total exports of beef in any single year, about 1.5 million tons. So you can see where, you know, not necessarily that our beef went and replaced that, but there was had to be replacement of that going to China. So from a global markets, we saw a lot of Brazilian beef move into the Chinese market. We're in pretty delicate market balances here. So something like that big correction of how much meat-based protein is in the world makes a big shock. So in 2018, we're selling off, and 2019, we're selling a lot of beef, and 70% of it, in fact, at the time, with live export, grew from about 10% to about 18% at the same time. That was all being consumed very easily, and why the price continued to go up, because we are driven by a global market,
yes,
and the longer term global markets rather than the short term kind of conditions.
But still our herds getting reduced
absolutely
at a really quick rate.
Yep, and the MLA, the government and so on, I would say I'd have given them a rap. They've done a great job of opening up markets all around the globe. So, you know, our largest market still today is Japan,
yes,
followed by the US, and we get a lot of 90CL, and I'll talk more about the 90CL meat and why that's a really important part of what's going to drive meat prices into the future. I'll talk about that a bit later if you like.
Yep.
But if I go back to my story of like where we're at, so 2018, 2019, we've had this big shock in China. We're selling cattle as quickly as we can because the seasonal piece is coming in. Fast forward now to 2020, and it's March 2020, two really big things, or late February 2020, two really big things happen. Number one, we all know because we're still living it today, which is COVID. And COVID is announced around the world. And things very quickly, restaurants close in New York and all around, and processes start to close, probably not because of the COVID specifically, but kind of because people were getting COVID, and you know, you could saw even here in Melbourne and so on, some processes had to close down. So consumption, or I should say demand, started to level off. And at the same time, we had the biggest rain event we've had in Australia in many, many years. So as I said earlier, you know, my parents had all this rain in sort of late February,
yeah,
and our selling, and I'd say this sometimes you're better to be lucky than kind of really well planned, our selling almost ceased completely because farmers are now, okay, I've got grass, I'm not going to be selling off, and they'd already sold down pretty well to their core breeding stock. You know, they weren't fattening a lot of cattle, they're really the fat cattle that we were selling at the time were coming out of feedlots and so on. So in a sort of a perfect storm, we had this 20-year low, because we were at 24 million, which we haven't been at 24 million herd in over 20 years, at the exact same time as COVID came in and we saw a bit of demand come off. Then we move forward into sort of 2020, you know, late 2020, I don't know, maybe October, November, and the restaurants around the world start opening up. And I know Australia's probably been a bit slower than that, but the US particularly, Europe and others, it started to open up and demand has really taken off again. In fact, even during that 2020 year, we didn't see demand drop off as much as what we thought it would because people were still cooking at home. In fact, you know, supermarkets and those sorts of things had record sales. So yes, they weren't out eating out much, but people were locked at home. So they were like, oh, you know, I'm going to get some steak, I'm going to have a nice dinner, I'm going to do all these kind of things. So demand was at a much higher level and our herd was really depleted. And we're 70% exporting our herd and we are the second largest supplier in the globe. So it's really just a big supply-demand curve that we've got here. I think you'll ask the question of, because we are the most expensive beef in the world at the moment, and you'll probably ask, why don't we import beef?
Did we import beef at all during the destocking process?
No, we didn't. And there's a story behind that as well. So very rarely do we ever see a situation when our meat prices, because where we are in the globe, are higher than particularly the US. And in 2003, there was a BSE scare that happened in the US. So that's mad cow.
Right.
If you're not sure what BSE is, that's what you'll hear as mad cow. And in 2003, the authorities, the government, if you like, banned imports of beef from the US, from Japan, I think another country, but I can't remember where exactly the country, I apologise for that. But really the big markets of US and Japan. And in about 2005 or six, there was kind of an approach back from both the US and Japan to reopen those markets. And the Australian government puts forward some protocols to so that they could re-enter those markets. And Japan actually went through the whole process of re-registering. And we do see a little bit of like really high value Wagyu steak come into Australia. But because of the economics has nearly never really lined up, the US have never gone through with the whole process of re-registering. So it's actually not possible to bring meat from the US or other countries into Australia. You can't bring anything with a bone back into Australia as it sits today.
Just to look at that destocking process. So in Australia, we've got a lot of different size farms owned by a lot of different sorts of people and companies. Was there a shakeout in terms of people that could no longer afford to sustain their farm operation because they destocked, their farm had no income left, and basically all they had was the land to sell, and so therefore there was a clean out and higher capitalized players, be they overseas players or be they Australian players, were able to come in and buy up some of these farms?
So I guess it's farming's very individual, and you know, individual businesses have got different tolerance risk and availability of capital and so on. And there's a lot of noise in the market around, so maybe I'll answer the foreign ownership question first. A lot of noise in that, but we're, you know, we sell about $4 billion worth of property through our Nutrien Harcourt's property business. And predominantly all of that is being sold farmer to farmer. It's large farmers getting larger, and it's not the corporates in the sense of corporates, it's large family farms. So this is what we're seeing in the market, is we're seeing the most successful farmers are the large family farms. And even when a corporate comes in and buys a farm, I personally see that as a good thing, because there's an horizon to that investment. You know, you can't pick up the land and take it back to the US or Europe or wherever this money is coming from. Normally they're well capitalized, they'll come in, put some great infrastructure, whether that's fencing or silos or some sort of land development on that property, make it a more viable investment than it was when they got that. And normally when these things are getting sold off, we see large families that are very successful in what they do take over these farms again. So, you know, we've seen a lot of that in the media just recently with Tim Roberts Thompson, 200 years of kind of corporate ownership and then taken over back by a large family farm. So I think that that's a really good example of that particular trend.
So if during the destocking process we've got a situation, normally you'd expect with any asset, farm's an asset, if it's not producing any income, that the price of the asset falls, but quite the reverse happened. Farmland went up in price even though income went down. The restocking process, was that relatively easy because a lot of the farm operations could go and source finance to restock based upon the increased value of their assets? Is that how it happened? Was there a lot more borrowing to start to buy cattle?
Yes.
And where did, and all of a sudden, if you, as I have, driven past these lush paddocks, how can you just go to the market and buy more cattle because you've already destocked? There's got to be an incredible time lag of having breeders and slowly building it up. You can't just, it's not like the supermarket, you just don't go and buy beef instantaneously because your grass is growing. How did that work?
Yeah. So if you're a farmer, and particularly a grazier, so your main income is from you know, buying stock or breeding stock and feeding them on your farm naturally with grass, then after a two-year drought where a lot of these farmers had destocked or really got low in stock, you probably had to be fairly adaptable. So we've seen some some cattle farmers that, you know, weren't able to get cattle, so they've bought some sheep, or they've bought some goats, or they've bought something else. Or we've seen some breeders that said, you know, we can't buy any more cows, we're going to buy some young steers, or we're going to have some heifers or whatever. So the breeding cycle of a cow, for a start, it's a 9 months gestation period. Then once that progeny is born, for a breeding cycle out of that progeny, you're looking for sort of 14 to 20 months, you know, before they hit puberty and then are able to breed themselves. And you're looking for a slaughter cycle of from birth to death, from or to slaughter for the prime cuts of meat, and it kind of varies depending on what product and what market you're aiming for. But the kind of prime cut that you'll be eating in a restaurant is going to be slaughtered somewhere in the 14 to sort of 20 month period.
So it's a big lag factor there.
A big lag.
20 months.
Yeah.
No matter, you can't change that, and it's got to happen slowly.
That's right. And that's why I don't see this, there is no cliff face in my mind coming for the price of beef or the price of cattle in Australia, because this is a long cycle of, it took a long time and probably expedited. If you think about where the price got from 400 cents in the ECI, so the Eastern Young Cattle Indicator, which is what the MLA kind of talk about, from a price 400
MLA
cents.
MLA is the Meat and,
the Meat and Livestock Australia.
Okay, yep.
So that's their reporting mechanism. If you think about it as a stock market indicator, this is a cattle price indicator.
Right.
400 cents to 1,000 cents took us 2 years to get to. It probably takes us 2 years to get back to some sort of market equilibrium. And I do think this is a different market that we will go through. And I think COVID's got a big lot to do with that. If you don't mind me talking about that just real quickly, you talked about farm income and droughts and how do they finance their working capital to restock and so on. Firstly, we've got vastly different banking rules in Australia, even for the farming community, than we have for your mortgage for your house. So, you know, we've tightened up on mortgages in the house, and everyone's heard about the credit crisis in the US. It was caused by, you know, subprime lending and so on. We've had a stronger housing market than that, in the sense of 20% deposit rates and so on, or equity rates. The agricultural sector is even stronger than that, 60% equity. In fact, even at the peak of the drought, most of our farmers were in that sort of 70% equity range.
So you're saying that the value of their property, 40% was financed, 60% they owned.
Correct. And also food security, through that whole period of time of COVID, I think really came to light. I feel like there's a change coming over the whole globe on food security, on, you know, economics drove everything before that, I think, for Australia. You know, everything's got to be manufactured at the lowest cost wherever it is in the world. And I feel like there's a bit of a pullback from that globalization of, let's balance this a bit more of, like, you know, we might need to be able to make some medical equipment and stuff here, and even though if it's not the cheapest place, we might need to, in the US or in China or wherever it may be, produce more of our own food and not be as reliant on some of the other countries, because some of those supply chains are very disrupted at the moment, as we can see. You know, about 70% of what our farmers make is exported. About 70% of the inputs to grow those crops is imported. So we've seen some of those supply chains get very stressed across the last 2 and 3 years, and I think that's really taught people a lesson, as sometimes the cheapest product is not always the smartest product.
Right, okay. During the process of restocking, to get the farm income back up, is there a strategy the farmer will use in terms of saying, okay, I have a certain percentage of my herd I'm going to have to sell on a continuing basis during this restocking process to create cash flow to pay for the bills, but then I'm going to hang on to, well, obviously the breeders, but what to breed with. Is there a strategy that they use to try and, as a good business practice, maintain the profitability of the farm?
I think it's just a longer cycle agriculture than any other investment, and I think lenders understand that. So there's about $12.5 billion of working capital at any one time in Australia that is linked to the Australian farmer. So that would be for fuel, for restocking, for crop inputs, and so on. And that'll come from the big four. It'll come from organisations like Nutrien Ag Solutions. So I think that's important to have these organisations strong in Australia, because we are a peaks and trough market. So, you know, we have, and this is not an advertisement for Nutrien, but we have deposit products. So when farmers have got excess capital, they can make some, you know, some reward for their excess capital. And we also have, you know, working capital facilities that we would finance the products that we sell, and also finance cattle or livestock with a longer term. And I think that we're the perfect organisation to do that, because also we're helping them get the most out of those commodities as well, whether that's livestock or cropping, whatever it may be. So I guess the answer is lenders really understand these. And this has been a strong, profitable business over a long period of time. If you think about the profitability of farms over a 20-year period, and farming in Australia more specifically, it's about a 13.5% return. It's slightly higher than the share market has been over the same period. It's a longer investment window, because there is bumps up and down in that, particularly in, it's about 9% capital gain, and it's about 4% or a bit over 4% in the operations of the business.
I thought your land prices in the last 12 months were between 20 and 30%.
It's been 15%. It's been 15% over the last 3 years, but it was kind of, land prices seem to do this. They'll rise quickly, then they'll plateau for a number of years, and then they'll rise quickly. So when you stretch that out over a 20-year period, yeah, it's been about 9.5%.
I've got to ask you this question then, Rob. If I've got an asset and it's got a capital gain around 20%, 20 to 30% in the last 12 months, and it's producing 13% income, I would walk over hot coals and crawl over broken glass to invest in that asset, because there aren't that many assets out there in the economy that provide such fantastic returns. And with an Australian dollar at, when I woke up this morning, at 70-71 cents, are we going to be overcome with a tsunami of overseas pension fund money that's going to want to buy up all of our agriculture?
I think there's a lot of money chasing agricultural land in Australia right now. We know that through our real estate business. There is, yes, the PSPs of the world and so on have got very successful operations here, and would love to have larger operations here. But land is held very tightly, and as I said, it's giving a 13% return. There's not a lack of buyers in agricultural land in market in Australia today. There's a lack of sellers, and for that exact reason. And I think that particularly the pension funds have really just woken up to this cycle. And I think this COVID piece, along with the financial crisis of 2008, has woken them to another investment that's got a whole lot of different risks to what the share market or the equities market may have. So the answer to your question is yes, but again, it's you know, you've got to find the land that's available to buy. And it's a long-term trend. I think I've been in this industry for, well, my whole life, but really in this business for 22 years. And I remember 22 years ago, Danny Burke, who was the manager of the IAMA, when I started there, talking about this kind of, you know, agriculture as the kind of the super cycle of tomorrow, and feeding the world, and, you know, 9 billion people by 2050, and all these things. And I think we're starting to see that. And I think, again, I'm repeating myself what I said earlier, but food security, governments have got two issues, right? Keep their borders safe and keep their people fed. You know, and I think that's really woken people up. People don't like to see empty shelves in supermarkets. And the world is resetting in my mind around how important feeding the globe is.
Okay, so you mentioned a key word there for me, supermarkets. If the price of beef changes at auction due to some of the factors we're talking about, what's the lag for that to go through to the shelf price at my local supermarket?
Yeah, well, the ACCC actually did a study on this. It was quite a while ago, but back in 2007. But they did find a correlation, and pretty strong correlation, albeit decoupled at times. So when I talk about, when you think about the supply chain, and you mentioned it earlier, you know, 2 years to kind of come from a breeding cow to a saleable item, there can be quite a lag effect in those. But over the longer term, the price that the farmer is getting is effectively flowing through to the supermarket. It can get decoupled, so we don't see automatically the prices that we see on farm or in the sale yards flow straight through to, I think the price has gone from 700 cents Eki a year ago to 1,000 cents, and we've seen about a 20% to 25% lift in the supermarket. But that's going to catch up. So do I think that meat prices in the supermarket are going to come off? No, I think they're going to probably catch up to that kind of 30% lift.
Is there any resistance from the supermarket chains, which in this country have an inordinate amount of market power compared to any other country in the world? Is there a resistance to accept increased pricing?
There hasn't been to date, and maybe that's because not as many people have been eating out and people have been eating in, and they're willing to pay for a nice steak because they're paying $50 for that steak at the restaurant, and they might be paying $30 a kilo for that steak at home. So maybe, I don't know the answer to that, or what happens when we get back to restaurants. I just had a nice King Island beef steak for lunch down at Pure South a minute ago with a friend of mine. But we haven't seen that resistance to date. The important part here is, again, we export 70% of our steaks, and our domestic market is in competition not with the domestic market, we're in competition with the global market. So, you know, economics would say that product's going to flow to the highest return. So if the local domestic market is not going to consume at that price, then they're not going to get the product.
It'll be sold overseas.
It will just go to the export market because demand is strong.
Okay, so under what conditions, are we going to get the conditions where supply is going to increase at an increasing rate and push price down as our national herd gets back to where it was? Farming practices are improving all the time, so presumably our national herd will be able to become larger than what it's ever come before, and that will have a downward increase on the price of our steaks. Can you see that happening?
I do see that the price today is going to level out and correct some. I think the answer to can we get through 30 million is what's the season going to do?
30 million being our national herd. Yep.
Is what is the season's going to do? And I'd like to think there's going to be 20 good seasons in a row, Ross, but it hasn't been before. So I think we are going to have this continue kind of up and down. So the answer in short is yes, I do think there's going to be a correction. Do I think it's going to go back to kind of 2017? No, I don't think it is.
And you're saying that because overseas demand?
Because we're in a growing planet. We're in a population growth. We're in a demographics growth. We've got more people eating meat. I just read something, the average person in the US today is now eating 25 kilos of meat in any single year. And if you think about how much meat we eat 13 kilos. So, you know, they love their meat and they're going to continue to love their meat.
Sure. If you've got all these farms, you've got all this rain, you've got all this pasture, you've got new technology, surely farmers with the profit motive that we all have in this country are going to just keep on breeding. The national herd is going to be exponentially bigger, 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 and that's going to drive prices down, unless what you're saying is the global demand is so immense it'll absorb everything that they can produce.
Well, I don't think it's going to be in Australia. I don't think it's going to be the global, I don't think it's going to be because farmers don't like money that stops it. I think it's going to be there's a finite amount of grass, and we're in an exceptional 2 year period. You know, we've come out of a very poor period into an exceptional period, and there is a finite amount of cattle that we can feed in Australia in the sense of the grass that grows and the season that grows them. So You're right, we are getting more efficient with farming, we are getting more sustainable with farming, we are in theory able to carry more livestock, but it'll still be 10% above what we could have carried under the same load of grass, if you like. So,
okay. You
know, we're still going to be capped by the amount of grass that is grown, because most of our cattle in Australia are grass-fed, naturally grass-fed cattle. So that's really going to be the capping point. It's not going to be just farmers stack more on. There's a finite amount that they can put on that particular field.
Now, I want to ask you the Bergenomics test. Out of anyone that could ever successfully complete the Bergenomics test, Rob, it's you, because if we look at a hamburger, there's a meat patty, there's a bun, there's cheese, and there's lettuce. So we've got vegetable growers, we've got beef growers, we've got dairy farmers, and we've got crops. They're the inputs. Tell us what's happening with the inputs for hamburgers at the moment, and where we would think the cost of hamburgers are going to go.
Well, I'll tell you what the major indicator is for me and where hamburgers are going to go, and I'll talk about the hamburger, like, say, the beef, if you like, and what the Americans would call the hamburger, the beef. And one of the really important factors I watch in the market is what they call the 90CL, which is, that's the trim that we take off all of the beef here in Australia. So if you think about, take out the prime cuts of beef, all of the trim that comes off, which is the major part of the carcass, most of that, that's our largest American market, and it gets put into hamburgers. So the cut that they put into hamburgers is actually 78CL, because most of the cattle that are in the US are all grain-fed cattle, so really high content in fat. They'll be somewhere between 50 and 60% CL. So what they'll do is buy our beef at 90CL and then blend it with this 50 and 60CL to make 78CL. And that market for 90CL is just continuing to go up, because the American consumer is just wanting to eat more and more beef. So to me, from a long term, what's going to happen to the price and the kind of leading indicator, if you like, of what's going to happen to our local price, is I watch that 90CL price in the US and see what that 90CL price is doing, because it will flow down from there. That price comes down and our price will effectively come down. It is a supply and demand story, but the global demand for protein is just continuing. And again, this big macro trend of countries wanting to be have more food security. You know, we're seeing half the corn in the world today is sitting in China, you know, building food stocks, building food security. You know, I think that we're very spoiled here in Australia. The way we think about agriculture, we think about it as a business, and it is a business. But it's the definition of an essential service. If you can't eat coal, you've got to eat. And, you know, we have the lowest subsidised farmers in the world here in Australia. And we think, you know, I hate the when I see on the news or whatever is the poor farmer. We're not the poor farmer. We're actually very successful farmers. But our nation doesn't have the same kind of, respect's the wrong word, but, you know, every other country in the world is subsidising their farmers because they know how important it is, because they've been hungry at some point in their kind of journey along the way. In Australia, we've always exported, you know, more recently in living memory, always exported more than we can eat. So that sort of food security thing isn't a big thing. So, you know, I won't go into each piece of the
Come on, you've got to go into each piece of the hamburger.
All right. Well, I think grain prices are going to drive the bun. So, you know, buns are made out of wheat. Particularly in the short term, we've got a lot of flooded wheat that's going to be downgraded in the next little while. There's been a big drought in Canada, particularly really low quality grain. Fertilizer prices are at an all-time high, so the input costs for that particular grain are going to go up.
Yep.
And then when you think about in the cheese and feeding what is predominantly grain-fed milking cows around the world,
yep.
You know, that's all going to flow through. So if you think you're going to get a cheaper hamburger in the next 12 to 18 months,
it's not going to happen.
I don't think it's going to happen.
Because our input costs for all of the sections of the hamburger, they're all going to go up.
Yep.
And because we're cheaper to buy because of our dollar and because of the practices overseas, again, it's global demand is determining where we're going with hamburgers.
It's economics 101. It's a supply-demand curve, and at the moment, we're in this too much demand and not enough supply. What I would say, Ross, is high prices always fix high prices, and the economics, again, in my mind, will drive farmers to produce more where they can get the best return. So we'll see some farmers potentially stop doing something. Like, so what I mean by that, they might stop growing hay for production for export and say, hey, there's a better return in having livestock, so I'm going to, instead of having hay on this, I'm going to switch to having livestock on this particular patch of my property. And economics will drive all that. You know, what's the best return for the inputs that I can put in the land that I've got?
Sure. Rob, thank you.
Thank you.
I think agriculture is fascinating, and I agree with you that it's certainly an unappreciated area of the total Australian economy. You've done a great job in explaining it to us.
Appreciate it, Ross. Thanks for having me.
Thank you. My thanks to those who made today's podcast possible. My guest, Mr. Rob Clayton, Managing Director of Nutrien Ag Solutions, Mr. Tim Roberts-Thompson, owner of the TRT Pastoral Group, Australia's leading grower of grass-fed Black Angus beef, and to Ology Creative for their design direction. Please leave any comments on our Twitter page, which is at Bergonomicspod, one word, or the Bergonomics Podcast Instagram page. And needless to say, please subscribe and review the Bergonomics Podcast on your favourite podcast provider.